Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
In this Connecticut East this week, we're talking transportation and a proposal for a new passenger rail system in eastern Connecticut, plus the alarming rise in pedestrian accidents on our roads, plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East this week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. Although the pandemic has kept our roads quieter than usual as we stay at home working and minimize travel outside of the state, there's been a steady increase over the last 5 years of pedestrian accidents on our roads. So much so, the Connecticut Department of Transportation recently issued a wide-ranging report outlining key tactics and programs they want to introduce to increase pedestrian safety across the state. But where do you start with such a massive task? Well, gathering crash data is important, and thankfully the state has a lot of that it can turn to. As Eric Jackson, director of the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center, explained to me. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So explain to us a little bit about what the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center does.
So we are a research center at the University of Connecticut. We are funded by the Connecticut Department of Transportation, and we are really involved with anything transportation safety related. Our primary goal is to collect motor vehicle crash reports that occur throughout the state. We compile them on the web, and then we provide some analytic tools that help the Connecticut DOT look at where crashes are occurring and why crashes are occurring, and then help devise plans to prevent those crashes from occurring in the future.
So it's a very important job that you do, and obviously the data is usable, I'm guessing, by multiple agencies, not just the Department of Transportation.
Correct. Yeah, our website is completely open to the general public. So anybody can go in and query crash data. They can look even at their own individual streets and their own towns, create maps and kind of get an idea of what's going on within their neighborhood and within their state in terms of transportation safety.
Now, just recently, the Connecticut Department of Transportation released their key strategies aimed at reducing what they are calling an alarming trend in pedestrian fatalities and serious injuries, and they want to create a strategy for that over the next few years. What sort of trends are you seeing, obviously, from all this data that you collect?
So some of the things that we're definitely seeing is there is an increase in the number of pedestrian death, which is kind of alarming. Overall, motor vehicle fatalities are going down, which is good, but we're seeing a larger percent of those fatalities actually being pedestrians. We're not 100% sure what's causing the rise or increase in pedestrians, but we're in the process now of trying to study what's going on and why we're seeing a lot more pedestrian fatalities than you would expect. And one of kind of the alarming things that we're noticing is the seasonality. So once you get into December, January, and February, those seem to be the peak times for pedestrian fatalities, which seems kind of odd because that's when you would expect people at least to be out walking around.
I'm guessing, and you may not be able to answer this, but possibly people aren't wearing sort of like fluorescent or sort of like clothing that can be seen maybe at those times of year as well. Because, of course, we do have a habit of, if we want to quickly take the dog for a walk or something, not necessarily think about, you know, maybe taking a flashlight or putting on a high visibility jacket. So I suppose it could be that could be maybe one of the factors that it's, you know, people wearing dark clothing and not being seen.
Absolutely. I mean, as days get shorter and nights get longer, those nighttime crashes occur more often.
The interesting thing is the DOT in their recent release, they said that the figures for 2019 and 2020 were still preliminary data and could change. But there was certainly an increase. We seem to be seeing an increase almost like year on year of pedestrian fatalities. Are we sort of like, is it just in, you know, from your data, is it just in the big cities, or is it basically happening across the board, even in like rural areas as well?
I mean, it's definitely happening across the board, and it's a trend that's happening across the country. So it's not just Connecticut that's seeing this increase in pedestrian fatalities. Other states are documenting and noting this trend as well.
One of the things I suppose that they've highlighted is speed. And of course, we all know that speed at any point, a vehicle versus a pedestrian, it's not going to necessarily be a good outcome. We are sort of seeing more speeding though, aren't we, just generally? I mean, I've been sort of like looking at reports and certainly since the pandemic, it certainly does seem to be that people, if they are out and about, are sort of like speeding more possibly because, I don't know, there's maybe less vehicles on the road.
Absolutely. And this is a major issue that we've identified during COVID. So traffic volumes are probably about 60% what they were when the lockdown went into effect. And what we noticed is that vehicles traveling above 80 miles per hour increased by a factor of 4. So the fewer vehicles on the road, people kind of took advantage of that. Or what we're also thinking is people kind of lost their sense of perception of how fast they were actually traveling, which you don't have people around you. So we noticed that during COVID, speeds increased dramatically. And as more people came out on the roadways, as the lockdown was lifted, we're not seeing a decrease in those speeds at all. So it's almost like everybody started driving faster and they're going to stay driving faster, regardless of how many vehicles are out on the roadway.
You said earlier that, you know, we're seeing this problem so like across the board and obviously across the nation. Just getting back to Connecticut for a moment, obviously the data that, that you can slice and dice, as it were. I mean, are you seeing an increase in so like some of the bigger cities, places like maybe New London or Willimantic or, you know, the Hartfords and New Havens, because just generally there's more people there and there is more traffic?
Yeah, absolutely. As you have more people out, more people, more exposure or more chance of running across a pedestrian or running into a pedestrian, those larger cities are seeing some increases as well, probably proportionally to what the rest of the state or other areas are seeing. We've seen fatalities coming out a lot on interstates where cars will break down or there will be an accident and then people will get out of their cars. And then they'll end up being struck and killed on the interstates. It's really wide-ranging in where we're seeing a lot of these crashes take place.
It almost seems like it's necessary to have a bit of a public awareness and education campaign going on, because I think people do forget, don't they, when they are on a high-speed road like an interstate, regardless of whether it's busy or not, it's just the speed that those vehicles are going on that particular road.
Yeah, absolutely. When we look at vehicle velocities, basically once you get around 25 miles per hour, for a pedestrian, a vehicle strike at that speed is almost always fatal. So kind of the campaign that's out there is Survive 25 in terms of making sure that you're in areas, if you're in the roadway, making sure that vehicle speeds are lower and that you're not putting yourself out where vehicles are traveling at a high rate of speed.
What sort of role do so like proper crosswalks play when it comes to maybe reducing public rundowns, you know, with vehicles? Because the problem that we have certainly in Connecticut is unless you live in a major city, a lot of the towns don't necessarily always have what I call full crosswalks in particular. You know, they're sort of like just the lines painted on the road and therefore you're putting your life in your hands a bit because you're in the road almost, as it were, with the cars still. I mean, does that play a role?
Oh, absolutely. So roadway design is a huge role in pedestrian safety. And drivers, especially in the rural areas of Connecticut, need to be aware of people walking on the side of the road or even cyclists that are in the road. But even in the urban areas, so if you design as an engineer a facility that makes it difficult for pedestrians to cross, or if there's a long wait time for pedestrians to cross, they're going to take the quickest way to get across. So we have to spend a lot of time really focusing on how we design our roadways and being able to provide a safe place for pedestrians and bicyclists to occupy the roadway. And then drivers have to pay attention to what they're doing when they're out on the roadway.
I've noticed in some sort of like Connecticut cities, and I think New Haven was the last place that I saw that they were possibly looking at doing this, is they've already got a like a fairly well-established sort of one-way system in certain parts of the downtown area. And they wanted to sort of like add to that. Do one-way systems sort of help to slow the traffic and therefore, you know, help with situations like this by way of redirecting that traffic in a sort of like a bit of more of a predictable flow and possibly, you know, help out pedestrians, as it were? Because we all know that as pedestrians, we don't always look, you know, both ways when we're crossing roads. So do one-way systems help?
I think there's an opportunity for those one-way systems to be able to help. Obviously, that as you mentioned, helps the pedestrians know where to expect traffic coming from. And the also the ability of being able to take some of that right-of-way produce curb bump outs to kind of shorten the distance that pedestrians actually have to walk to get across the roadway is another way to kind of help in those situations. And with a one-way street, you can potentially do some of those pedestrian treatments that make it easier for a pedestrian to cross the street.
And what about bicycle paths as well? Because we seem to be seeing an increase in those. And, you know, I come from a country where, of course, it's a lot smaller. And although there are many cars, the roads are narrower anyway, sort of thing. But I mean, there was quite a lot of bicycle paths there. We're sort of seeing it a lot more now, certainly here in Connecticut, as people are choosing different methods to get around. Do cycle, you know, designated cycle paths also help with that situation in trying to keep, you know, cars and pedestrian stroke cyclists away from each other?
Absolutely. So trying to separate pedestrians, bicyclists, and cars is a great way to reduce those conflict points. And those conflict points are where pedestrians or bicyclists are struck and are injured. So separating them, providing them with a buffer zone or a way to get away from traffic, it also sets up a way for them to actually participate in signalized intersections or intersections that they approach. There's a kind of a spot for them to wait for the light to turn green. They're not mixed in with vehicles. So providing those dedicated pedestrian and bike facilities really is key and critical for producing a safe and efficient transportation system.
At the end of the day, I mean, it's everyone's responsibility, isn't it? I mean, you know, we can very easily turn around and blame a driver of a vehicle, or we can blame a pedestrian. But I mean, when it comes to the roads and, you know, being on them or near them, it's really all of our responsibility, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. One of the other trends that we are seeing is both drivers and pedestrians, we're seeing a lot of impairment. So whether it's the pedestrian that's impaired and out in the roadway, or if it's the driver behind the wheel that's impaired, it's really and truly decisions that people make as they get out into the transportation system that cause these crashes to occur. If you look at the statistics that are kind of published out there, 90%+ of traffic crashes are due to driver error or pedestrian error. It's human error that causes these crashes. Very few of them are actually caused by the roadway geometry or bad roadway design. So we need to be vigilant. You need to be, when you're out there, dedicate all of your attention to driving. And if you're a pedestrian, dedicate all of your attention to watching the vehicles that are around you. So try and remove some of those distractions that could end up in a situation where you get struck by a vehicle.
Eric Jackson, Director of the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and thank you for giving us an insight into the work that your organization does and how you help us ultimately and hopefully be a little bit safer when we're out on the streets and the roadways of Connecticut. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
If you live in eastern Connecticut, you'll know trying to use the railway system here is limited, with services running along the shoreline to either New Haven or into Rhode Island and beyond. But what if you want to travel to Hartford more directly, or say even Massachusetts? Well, an expanded passenger train service running through this part of the state that could take you to those destinations could be on the cards if a House bill gets passed later this year. Several local state representatives have put forward the idea, and I spoke to one of them, State Representative Christine Conley of the 40th District, covering Groton and Ledyard. Representative Conley, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me today.
Yourself and several other colleagues of yours have put forward a bill to the General Assembly concerning the expansion of passenger train and ground transportation services here in eastern Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about it, because it's very exciting. And I'll be very honest with you, when I started looking into this, I thought, gosh, this is going to cost a lot of money. And then suddenly realized, maybe it may not actually cost as much money as we all thought it would.
I would say in the fall, right around election time, a constituent of Joe Dela Cruz and mine, Zell Stever, came up to us and said, what can we do to utilize these freight lines better? You know, the freight lines that come from New London up through Groton and then actually connect to Worcester. Is there a way we can start working and getting some passengers on these lines? And we said, well, that seems like something we should look into, how to best use our infrastructure. So over between election time in the fall and January, we started in session. Zell Stever worked with myself, Anthony Nolan, and together with Zell and members of the Transportation Committee, we created this bill. We can utilize the freight lines for passengers and how we can expand Shoreline East through Groton into Stonington and hopefully pick it up, connect it over to some Rhode Island lines. So hopefully We said it won't be happen tomorrow, but hopefully after some time, we could have folks actually be able to take an easy train up to the airport in Providence, or have folks who need to commute up to Boston or can do that a lot easier, get some more cars off the road and get some folks back and forth to Pfizer and EB from the middle of Connecticut, from Colchester or from a little north. And again, get some more cars on the road and make it easier for people to get back and forth to work and start improving our trains.
Why was this important to you? I mean, we all know that we have very congested roads, and certainly here in the eastern part of Connecticut and the I-95 corridor, it is very, very congested. But what was it that drove you all to consider, as I say, what is a very ambitious plan, even with the rail lines already in place?
So I think we all talk a lot on the phone. You wouldn't be surprised. When we go to the Capitol, there's generally the first person who leaves from this area will start the phone tree as to where the traffic is. And we spend a lot of time sitting in traffic, talking to each other on the phone. So we see the congestion on a regular basis. And we know not just is it a time factor, but it's our cars are emitting pollutants into the environment. Having all these people and all these cars isn't the best way to continue to proceed. I work very close, my law practice is very close to Electric Boat. So I see the cars come in when the shift starts and the cars leave when the shift leaves. And we've talked, how can we get more people taking public transport? So having trains, having bus lines, having, you know, more public transport options will help not only people to get back and forth to work easier, but will help our environment.
The other thing that you've proposed in this proposed bill is that the service would also provide up to Massachusetts as well. I can certainly understand along the I-95 corridor going into sort of Rhode Island and then further on into Boston. Why do you think it's essential to like go up into Massachusetts?
So that freight line that is basically runs pretty close to 395 goes all the way up and already connects to Worcester. So we have folks who, like folks who live in Colchester, work down in Groton in my district, folks also travel up north to work. So we wanted to make sure, you know, there are a lot of businesses in Worcester. There's a lot of need to go where people might be commuting back and forth. Or folks up in Worcester could need to come down here, or even for tourism, may want to go to our casinos, take a train down instead of take a car down.
Now, of course, as I said at the top of this, it's all very ambitious and very interesting. And you've mentioned, obviously, about the rail lines that are already there. Of course, it all comes down to cost at the end of the day. Have you or your elected colleagues, you have in mind how much you think this would cost? Or is that something that you still have to look into, you know, if the bill is obviously passed?
It's a bill to get a feasibility study to get all these details worked out. And a lot of these, there's options for federal funding, there's options for state funding, but the first step is this feasibility study where the Department of Transportation would look at the rails that we have, look at our desires, and then tell us what the steps are. There are federal permitting with the rails, federal paperwork to go through to do different things with the rails, but since the rails are there and they're used often, it will be far less costly than putting down new rails from the start.
Obviously, stations would have to be built. I mean, there's still probably a fair amount of work, I'm guessing, even, you know, with the rail lines down there. Because, of course, one of the issues that we do suffer from and have suffered in the past is, you know, the rail lines here in Connecticut and going all the way to the New York border have not always been looked after. So, I mean, it could still end up being a fairly costly project. And it's clearly going to take a guessing, even if it was, you know, agreed to. It's going to take a number of years for this to really come to fruition, isn't it?
It is, yes. This is a long-term project. This is not an overnight project. Anytime that you're using freight lines for other purposes or using rails from other purposes, you do have to get permissions, paperwork from a variety of sources. And of course, you know, we have to build or look at our current stations, look at stations that maybe have not been used in a while, make sure things are ADA compliant. And there is a little bit of work, but just because it requires work and requires time doesn't mean today isn't the right time to start.
And tell us a little bit more about the role of Zell Stever, who's been sort of like assisting with this project, because that's fascinating in itself as well.
Zell has been a force in Groton for a while. He's part of the conservation, Groton Conservation Advocates, and is on our Groton Sustainability Task Force.
So he reached out to all three of us, Joe Dela Cruz, Anthony Nolan, and myself separately. And then when we meet together, the three of us, we all said, you know, Zell Stever reached out about this, and we realized he had spoken to all of us. And we thought, let's talk about this idea. And we did, and we all agreed it was a great idea. And then he's been great. He actually did some of the drafting of the language. He has a lot of skills and abilities to draft, and started off helping our assistants drafting some language. And then he was able to testify. He's been great providing us background information, doing research for us. He's really been a huge help in this bill so far. So we appreciate having him.
And what about the state as well? What about the Department of Transportation? Because ultimately this is something that they would be looking at if it goes through, wouldn't they?
Their process actually starts once we pass the bill, with them doing the feasibility study and starting to do their paperwork. They always talk about, you know, make sure that they have time in their workflow, but they're not against this project in any way. They seem very supportive. It's just a timing issue that when this passes, to make sure that they get their workflow correctly. They do have a little bit of delays in other projects because of COVID and some of our transportation projects. In all of our businesses, some things have been a little difficult on how to get materials, people, paperwork back and forth. So we do want to be respectful of their time and their other duties, but I think certainly having a feasibility study is something that they can schedule appropriately and get moving forward on this project.
I think we all recognize the benefit of using other forms of transportation, you know, like trains, and trying to get ourselves out of cars and helping the environment. The only question I would put to you, Representative Connolly, is that CT Rail only fairly recently, in the last couple of years, has managed to really increase use of the rail service from New Haven up through sort of Hartford and into Springfield. Do you think there genuinely will be sort of an audience for this, especially as we're hopefully coming out of this pandemic and we're seeing a lot of people saying, hey, I'm not going to be going back to work as regularly as I used to. And that's the people who used to commute and possibly use train services, like possibly even into New York City.
Some of what we do every day has changed drastically. Even us representatives and senators, when we have our phone trees about traffic and which is the easiest way to get in and out of Hartford, we do go a little less these days, but a lot of things still need to happen by going to work. So hospital workers still need to go into the hospital. Nursing home workers have to go to the nursing home. And workers at Electric Boat, you can't take those submarines home. So you have to go there to build them. Even when I talk to folks at Pfizer, you can do some of the paperwork, maybe remoting in on your own. There's a lot of things that we still do need to do in person. And I think as we all get vaccinated and feel a little more comfortable, there's a lot of things that I know I've been doing on Zoom meetings that would just be a little easier if we were in person. I don't think we're ever going to get back to the old way of doing things. But I know I've heard friends who do business travel are back flying a little bit, not the same as they were before. And other folks are back to doing some meetings. So it is going to take us a little while. This isn't an overnight project, like I said before. So by the time people feel a little more comfortable going into regular office jobs again or into the city again, we should be a little smarter as to how we can get these rails moving and how we can get some more folks off the road. Like, I know something I enjoy doing is going into New York City. I'm not quite ready, but I'm sure Broadway will be up at some point, hopefully this summer. People rely on those jobs to get back to work, and the tourism will come back soon too.
Well, we will be eagerly watching to see what happens to this. But in the meantime, thank you ever so much for giving us some more context on what potentially could be a huge project, you know, for this part of Connecticut. And as I say, thank you ever so much for joining us, Representative Christine Connolly, on the podcast.
Thank you.
And House Bill 5423, which we've just been discussing, will be voted on by committee at the end of March, and if successful, will go on to a House vote by the end of July.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently, sponsored by...
The Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling is a nonprofit organization which, through advocacy, prevention, and education, is here to support individuals and families who are impacted by problem gambling. Our helpline, 1-888-789-7777, is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We also have live chat and tech support through our website, www.ccpg.org.
In the Connecticut Examiner this week, Eversource will be prevented from recovering a large portion of the costs of Tropical Storm Isaias. State utility regulators announced recently in a draft decision based on an investigation into widespread and lengthy power outages stemming from the August 2020 storm. The state's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA, will still take public comment on the decision before the board can vote on whether to approve the decision. But its investigation concluded that Eversource was not reasonable or prudent in managing its municipal liaisons, executing the Make Safe programs, communicating critical information to customers, or in securing adequate resources in the first 48 hours of the storm response. In the day this week, a New London woman charged in connection with the death of her four-year-old son allegedly told police that she killed him to get revenge on her mother and that she was excited that she killed him by strangling him and feeding him CBD gummy bears. 33-year-old Tiffany Ferralto allegedly told a New London police officer that she killed her son to get back at her mother, who she said she blamed for her own failures, according to an unsealed arrest warrant obtained by the newspaper. Ferralto appeared in court, where she was ordered to a 60-day hold at a mental health facility. Her mother, Cindy Steenson, sat in the courtroom and wiped tears from under a protective face shield as her daughter was brought in from the York Correctional Institution and deemed not competent for trial. Ferralto's son, identified as David Jasmine, was found dead in their home at 242 Nautilus Drive, with lacerations and abrasions across his chest and marks on his neck. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, Senator Cathy Austin parted ways with every other member of the General Assembly by casting the only vote against the nomination of Governor Lamont's former top legal adviser, Robert Clark, to the State Appellate Court. Austin's relationship with the Lamont administration has grown increasingly fraught, most notably over whether her constituents, the Mashantucket, Pequot and Mohegan tribes, should have exclusive rights to sports betting and online gambling in the state. Clark, who was the governor's general counsel until his nomination, had been involved in the often difficult negotiations that led to a recent deal in which the tribal owners of the state's two casinos will share sports betting with the Connecticut Lottery. He had stepped back from the talks in recent weeks as the administration first cut a deal with the Mohegans, a move that outraged the Mashantucket Pequots as well as Austin. In the Middletown Press this week, state officials and healthcare providers say there's a strategy to finding a COVID vaccine appointment that isn't weeks away. Demand has shown little sign of slowing as the state logged 80,000 new vaccine appointments in the first 3 days for the 45 to 54 age group when they became eligible on March 19th. As people pour into the system, complaints often surface about few available appointments, but officials say availability is subject to change almost daily. Competent people will find vaccines in the 2-week window until the next eligibility expansion. The state had asked providers to not book appointments for this group past mid-April. Since the state announced its aggressive plan to open eligibility up to everyone by April 5th, vaccine supply has mostly increased, but not dramatically. And in the Chronicle this week, University of Connecticut officials in stores have announced plans for the fall semester, including an increase in in-person classes and residential capacity. The announcement was made by UConn President Thomas Katsoulis and other UConn leaders recently in an email to the UConn community. UConn spokesperson Stephanie Reitz added in an email that there had been 3 new on-campus positive cases and 3 new off-campus cases. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, we catch up with 2 members of the military who have recently won awards for their service above and beyond. We talk to a Navy diver based at the New London Submarine Base and a cadet at the Coast Guard Academy in New London to find out more. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East and on Instagram at Connecticut East This Week, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Thank you for listening.